ultimately, like, when you're struggling, you can't really win with fans.
Plus, I love to score the games because it just keeps me engaged. I've got to pay extra attention.
Brian Price in the New York media.
Oh man, now this has to happen.
It'd be the best 45 seconds on record. And welcome to Artificial Turf Wars, episode number 18, the podcast that can fit 7 baseballs into 1 hand. I'll let you picture that for a second, and I will let you know that we are joined tonight by Joshua Howsam. Josh?
Hey.
How are you? Your usual self. And Nick Dyka from Baseball Prospectus Toronto. How are you, Nick?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, guys.
Hey, no problem. Welcome to the iProgram is the correct word. Can't be a show because we
can't. The iProgram? So were we Apple sponsored?
Yes, absolutely. Because if you, hey, if anybody's going to sponsor us, we got no traction on that avocados from Mexico thing I tried a few weeks ago. None.
Weak.
So Apple, call us up. This week, we're going to talk about a very recent revelation to us as we're recording about Aaron Sanchez from Ross Atkins. Marcus Stroman, is he improving or not? Gavin Floyd did not improve. As a matter of fact, he is out for quite some time. We'll get into the details, and a couple of other relievers might be coming back. Devin Travis, the return of the hitter we knew last year. We have an interview with Sportsnet's Hazel May. Been working on that for a while, so we're looking forward to you hearing that. We, as usual, have listener questions, a do-over, and possibly even a final thought. Where shall we begin? We shall begin with the fact that we're a day early, so they've only played 4 games, and the Blue Jays are 1-3. How are you feeling, Josh?
Well, first off, I'm a little discombobulated because we're recording this on a Tuesday. I was like, I don't know what's going on here. But in general, obviously, it sucks. And it's one thing to lose 2 of 3 to Chicago, which was bad enough, but then they blew the game against Colorado. So, you know, it's one thing, they didn't get blown out, they just lost games they should have won.
So, Nick, how do you feel about this bullpen over the last week as compared to, I don't know, say the 2 weeks previous where things maybe were looking a little better?
Well, I think it's definitely something where, you know, not only is it physically the same guys doing it, but, you know, none of it's come as kind of a surprise. There's nobody back there, you know, other than Asuna, that, you know, was pitching, like you said, well in the 2 weeks previous and not so well in the last week. It doesn't, when you have the guys back there that you've got, I think this kind of volatility is to be expected, and it's not really, you know, it's not out of the normal range of outcomes for guys like Storn and Biagini and Floyd before he was hurt to kind of oscillate in performance like they have. And it's not, yeah, it's just like, I think this is kind of the performance you're going to get from that crop of people or of relievers.
Which is interesting, though, because with Storin specifically, it's not at all what anybody expected coming into the season, because he was remarkably consistent with Washington.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, I'm meaning kind of this new version.
Storin 2.0?
Yeah.
Fozzie Bear.
Not throwing as hard. And
Waka, waka, waka.
He looks like Fozzie Bear. The bigger that beard gets.
But he doesn't walk people, he hits them.
Yeah. Oh, last night. I don't want to get into too many details, but when you hit two guys with 2 strikes on them in the same inning, it's just that kind of thing drives me up the wall as a fan. It's like, what happened?
Yeah,
and did he not hit 1 lefty and 1 righty?
Yeah, and the lefty's with a fastball, which was really weird. So are you say something there, Nick?
Oh, I was just saying that, like, as a fan, this is kind of like nothing, you know, in the last 4 games has been particularly surprising. You know, this is kind of the bullpen that we have, and given that, like, I'm just, other than Osuna, you know, nobody comes in where I'm thinking this is locked down, and, you know, I don't even think I'm mad at or upset at guys, you know, like Storin and Chavez when they give up ding dongs anymore, because that's kind of who these guys are, and, you know, they're not the shutdown bullpen of the Yankees or the Royals or anybody like that. And so my thinking is, if we want things to improve, you know, we just kind of, like, kind of bite down and hope Cease gets back here soon.
Not just Brett Cecil. You have almost taken my segue. We've tried everybody. We have Franklin Morales potentially too, right?
Yep.
And they are the one thing that this bullpen really, really lacks is a guy who can consistently get left-handers out. And John Gibbons has been riding for a whole now 3 months without a guy who can get left-handers out.
Yeah, and Doran yesterday was facing two or three lefties in a row at one point, and he turns them into Mike Trout. You know, they just don't have that guy. And if you get Brett Cecil back, all of a sudden you have an eighth inning pitcher, righty or lefty, and then Franklin Morales can come in and he can really handle left-handed pitchers because he throws hard and he's got that big curveball. So if those guys are healthy, which they seem to be healthy enough, Franklin Morales had 10 pitches to face the minimum today in AAA, then you're in good, well, not good, but at least passable shape, which right now they are not.
So I will give you the depressing slash impressive stat of the night on the last sort of note on the bullpen here. James and T.O. tweeted both of these out because he's always my source for Jay's stats. If you don't follow him, what's wrong with you? Number one, the Jays, when leading after six innings, are 33-10, which is kind of depressing. Bad. Now, the bright side is nobody except the Cubs has had a lead more often after six innings. So if they do manage to get to average with the bullpen, the rest of the ingredients are there to keep, you know, to give them a lead on a regular basis. I don't know if that's, you know, that happy, but it's happier than, you know, well, being the White Sox, I guess. Oh. All right, so our breaking, past week, we've already, you know, I tee things up in a certain order, and now we're everywhere. Someone who's not going to the bullpen is apparently Aaron Sanchez. So saith Ross Atkins. Thoughts,
well,
Josh?
Well, yeah, he didn't say he's not going. Let's make that a little clearer. What he basically said was that as long as everything is looking fine, then they're not going to, which we've sort of talked about this on the podcast in the past, that, you know, like if his release point and his velocity and his spin and all of that stuff stays the same and there's no indications that he's wearing down, then there's no reason to move him away.
Now, Nick, when you hear that from Atkins and then you hear Gibbons talk, do you think that possibly there's a discussion that hasn't happened there?
It sounds to me like that there, I feel like we've heard a lot, like over the course of the year, you know, because Ross Atkins' comments today are the latest in like a series of comments from Gibbons and the front office, like leading up to this date. It seems like they either aren't totally sure what they want to do, or they're just not being completely forthcoming. And my guess would be it would be the second of those two things. But yeah, no, it's I find it kind of perplexing just exactly what their ideas are and where this is actually going to go out, or where it's going to kind of like end up, because the one thing it seems to me though is if they did have like a plan to really stick with Sanchez in the rotation all year, it seems like they'd be skipping him more often or taking him out of games earlier, because it doesn't really seem like they've done much of that so far this year at all. Like, I mean, they've only skipped him what, twice?
Well, they haven't even really skipped him. They've just sort of moved him back.
Right.
So yeah. To your point, I honestly think that it's more what Atkins is saying, and that Gibbons sort of, it's like, you know, is under the impression that they're monitoring him with the intent of potentially moving him to the bullpen. But Gibbons just distills that down to the lowest thing, which is innings limit. Right. What? Gibbons be well aware that it's not that. But when he's speaking, he's not going to go into the detail. He just says innings because that's what people understand.
And I think that's also sort of what in baseball terms Gibbons understands. I don't think he's dumb, don't get me wrong, but I think in the sense of a on the ball field all the time ball player, he doesn't really think about release point because he's not a pitching coach, and he doesn't think about spin rate because he doesn't have those numbers in front of him. Like, I think he thinks in terms of, well, when they told me he's reached his limit, for all intents and purposes, that's when he's thrown enough innings.
Yeah, but so it's all the same thing. It's just basically, it's like there is a plan at some point that he could go to the bullpen, and so just think of it one way or the other.
Indeed.
Right. The confusing thing to me, though, and I think like some other people have talked about this too, is the idea of like monitoring things like his release point and velocity. Like at that point, if he's lost his release point or he's not throwing as hard, is he going to be effective in the bullpen either way? Like,
yeah, I mean, speaking just from pitching experience in general, what happens there is that you go back and they would shut him down for a few days longer and then send him back to work out of the pen, and that extra bit of rest between the starts would do wonders for his arm.
Right. Okay.
You hope.
I mean, he wouldn't be fatiguing in the middle of games as well, right?
Right. Right. Okay. Cool. That's so. There's a way to kind of do both, essentially.
Yep.
Yeah. Nice.
The trick here is you're riding the horse until just before it drops, which is a super tricky thing to do, if you ask me. That's all I'm saying. Okay. Yes, you. What do we have next? We have Devin Travis. I think we should move on to a happy moment, or do you want to go to Stroman first as a semi-happy moment, kind of build our way up to Devin Travis?
Well, we'll round out the pitchers first.
Okay. Nick, your thoughts on Stroman's comments after his last start that he was, we may not have noticed, but he felt better.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's still kind of like he's more aware of how he's feeling and how he's doing than we are. It, you know, from like watching on TV and stuff, it kind of looks the same as what had happened before. And he did admittedly run into some more bad luck in the White Sox start than he had before that. But, like, you know, he pitched well against the Phillies, and, you know, then he's come out since then and hasn't pitched as well. So, like, in terms of a turnaround, I'd still just want to see a lot more than we've seen so far. And that's not to say he can't do it or he's not going to do it, just that I still don't think it's happened yet, given the White Sox start.
He definitely hasn't turned it around. But what's interesting is that he was throwing harder. It was the first starts, his last two all season, where he's hit 95 miles per hour at any point. So he's at least attempting to do something different. So a couple starts ago against Philly, he started throwing his breaking ball, his slider, harder. Now he's throwing the harder fastball. So he's trying to do something different, which is the encouraging start. Obviously, as you mentioned, it's not working yet, but at least there's a hint. Just this, not about Stroman, but it's sort of related. This came from Cole Hamels via Eno Saris. Hamels said he can't throw his sinker much because batters don't swing at it, you know, when movement takes it out of his zone, even though it has incredible movement and velocity. It's sort of similar to Stroman, just on the reverse. Like, he's got this sinker that moves really well and it's hard, but batters are just tee it up because it just always sits in the same part of the zone. So it'll be interesting to see if he makes similar adjustment where just because a pitch is good doesn't mean it's good to throw it.
And that's the difficult part about that pitch mix of having all those things in your pocket, I think. And all of them are good on paper, as the great, you know, I think Jeff Sullivan article last year went over each pitch, and it can be compared favorably to somebody else's very, very good pitch. But he obviously hasn't found that combination that's worked. Well, first of all, worked to get strikeouts, which is still, I think, the central issue, is this is a strikeout game, and Marcus Stroman still doesn't know which pitch is going to get him those strikeouts. And there has to be some combination or sequence in there that does it.
Yeah. I read an article earlier in the year about Rick Porcello and the changes he's made. And I think the thing that's similar between him and Stroman is they're both very sinker heavy. And in the article, it was talking about some of Porcello's success this year has come from basically going to the sinker early, but then
and forcing fastballs up.
Yeah, later in the count. And I don't know if that's something that will work for Stroman or not, as in terms of, you know, speaking to what you're talking about in terms of figuring out that right mix. But like you guys were saying, the idea that he has been trying different things, and I think just from what we know about Stroman in general, he does seem like a guy who's very willing to adapt and try to do, like, take the best practice and all that stuff. So I think this still does bode well for his chances to make changes and adapt.
Yep. Yeah. I'm willing to agree with that.
I would also like to just tell all the people who think that his attitude and the fact that he is very vocal about how he's feeling and how he's doing, and he's vocal on the field, and that's the problem, those people are rather thick, in my opinion. I don't. Well, it's just yet another. It's like a smokescreen for what the actual problem is yes, it might be mental, it might be physical, it might be a combination of both, but it's certainly not that he's too enthusiastic. That whole thing, and it keeps coming up and it drives me crazy.
Well, the other thing on that is, like, I'm thinking back to like Vernon Wells, who, when he struggled, he didn't really say anything, and he was kind of the anti-Stroman in that sense, and people didn't like that either, right?
Yeah,
like people said he didn't care, and you know, he wasn't interested in playing and all that stuff. So it's almost like, ultimately, like, when you're struggling, you can't really win with fans, and people are gonna find, they're gonna be able to diagnose why you're struggling and what's wrong with you that's leading to the struggling. But it's kind of all bullshit anyway.
Hey, it wasn't me who forced you to bring out the bleep button this time.
Oh, sorry.
Write down the time, and we'll put the bleep in. Well, one trip out, Nick, and you've already been bleeped. All right. Devin Travis is the good news story here, I guess. His line in May was 208, 240, 250 while he was still in spring training facing major league pitching, effectively, for an OPS of 490. His June line, if you were curious, 293, 322, 561, an 883 OPS. Not exactly double, but pretty close.
Yeah.
This guy was one for one for Anthony Gose, and nobody thought he could hit.
Well, okay, that's not really the case. The opinions on him were completely split. There was, like, Baseball America had him ranked as the Tigers' number one prospect, and then people like Keith Law said non-prospect, because he had always hit in the minors, but he just didn't have the tools, the loud tools that people said he would hit in the majors. So, you know, it depends on the camp. The hitters hit camp loved him. And obviously they were so far pretty right on him, because who saw this? Like, the power, they saw the contact, but the power, very odd.
Indeed. But he had the power last year too, and even he was surprised. So, yeah. I mean, if you make good contact, I think, you know, with solid mechanics, there's that old saying, right? If you try and hit a home run, you can't hit a home run.
Unless you're Matt Stairs.
Or Reggie Jackson. But I think those guys are really exceptions to the rule, aren't they?
I suppose.
All right.
Fine, be no fun, Greg.
All right. So, Nick, do you want to say maybe Edwin Encarnacion, is he hotter than Devin Travis or not as hot as Devin Travis?
I think, like, with Edwin, we've almost come to expect it, you know? Like, these streaks are, like, kind of part of his DNA, I think, at this point. And I mean it feels better coming from Travis, just kind of going from, you know, who, like, when we had the, like, Goins and Barney playing second base, it feels like seeing Devin Travis in there, it feels so much better. You see the lineup and you don't have another black hole. And so I'm gonna say like Edwin's still hotter, but it feels better to have Travis in there hitting like he's hitting.
Fair enough. Yeah, because I did at some point look at Edwin's splits for where was it? His OPS for the 3 months: 694 for April, 817 for May, which is respectable. 1200 for June. Which is just ridiculous.
It's just Edwin being Edwin, you know.
Every time, every year,
just when he's on, he's just on. Like, nobody can pitch to him.
It's unreal.
And the interesting thing too is just seeing, like, the who the Jays should sign pendulum just swing back and forth between
him and Bautista.
Yeah. It's just like Bautista's on the shelf now. Edwin's getting hot. You know, we'll see what July and August bring, and it's just hilarious how reactive the who you got to sign thing kind of swings back and forth.
Well, obviously the most intelligent strategy, as far as the fans is concerned, is to take the last 2 weeks of performance and commit three or more years to a guy based on that. That's really all it's about, isn't it?
Wait, there's another way to do things?
No. Actually, we do have some words from Hazel May about Edwin Encarnacion coming up at the end of the interview. So I think we're going to move to that. And then we will come back with listener questions and other assorted things that we do after interviews around here. We will see you in a bit. And we are happy today to be joined by Sportsnet's Hazel May. Hazel, I would like to welcome you for the first time to Artificial Turf Wars. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and thanks for having me. I know we've been trying to do this for quite some time, and I'm happy it worked out today.
A few missed connections, but now we're all in one virtual place. So
I'm glad to be with you guys.
We are reaching you in Colorado, in Denver, where I guess the topic of the moment is Troy Tulowitzki's return to the city.
Yeah.
How do you think that he's going to be received by the fans in Colorado?
You know, it's interesting. We obviously knew this day was going to come. So we had been, you know, off the record kind of talking to Troy about how he'd like to kind of handle things and, you know, whether he wanted to go back to rehashing that messy divorce from the Rockies. And our sense in speaking to Troy is he's, you know, excited to be, and this is what he said on the record, he's excited to be going back to Colorado, a place where, of course, he called home for 10 seasons, and to see the fans, and he's got still a very tight-knit circle of friends there. But to be honest, and he was very frank about it, he has no desire to go back down that road and rehash what happened almost a year ago. As much as he has on the record said that he has moved forward, he thinks things happen for a reason, he's happy to be a Blue Jay, but you have to feel that there's still a little bit of the bitterness in just how it all went down. There are some unconfirmed reports that if he had not been traded, that he would have, you know, retired as a Rocky, and maybe there may have been a place for him within the organization. But when he was very upfront with the front office and asked them to just keep him in the loop, because he knew they were still rebuilding, the team wasn't going anywhere, and out of respect for Troy, they were looking for trades. And of course, we all know the story from there. He was kind of blindsided when he was at Wrigley Field playing against the Cubs. And now that we're here, I'm going to be very interested to find out, you know, the kind of emotions, what he is thinking, what he's feeling when I get to the ballpark, because he has made a point of telling the Blue Jays PR that he will only speak one time, and he will do it in front of both the Toronto and Colorado media. He's not doing any sit-downs. He's not doing any one-on-one chats because, as far as he's concerned, he knows the spotlight will be on what happened a year ago, but he wants to keep that kind of attention at the bare minimum. So if he has to address it, and he knows he has to, he's doing it in one fell swoop. It'll be at 4 o'clock Mountain Time, 6 o'clock Eastern. It'll be in the Blue Jays dugout. He didn't want it in front of a podium. He didn't want all this bells and whistles of his homecoming. And we're going to be in a huge scrum. I'm sure there's going to be like 100 media personalities there. And I'm going to try to have to carve out my space and just listen to what he has to say. He really is trying to keep it as basic and not as flashy as it can possibly be. Of course, I'm turning on the Colorado News, and the sports anchors are all talking about his return. So I don't know how much he can try to keep it at, you know, a bare minimum as far as attention goes. But we will see. I know there's a lot of mixed emotions, and I think that's the best way I can put it, because he certainly was still very upset about what happened a year ago.
Well, make sure you throw some elbows when you're going into that scrum. It'll help clear some space.
Oh, I know. I know. I can only imagine. According to the Blue Jays PR guys, they've been inundated with Colorado reporter requests. And they're trying to, you know, they're trying to please everybody. Of course, as the home broadcast network, we're trying to get our 2 cents in there, too. So we'll see what happens today. But I'm sure there's going to be a lot of butterflies as far as what kind of reception he's going to get. Listen, at the end of the day, he didn't ask to be traded. He didn't demand a trade. He got traded. So fans have to understand that. He was such a huge part of their franchise, one of the most popular players in franchise history, 5-time All-Star, 2-time Gold Glove winner, 2-time Silver Slug winner. He did so much for this
franchise, really put them on the map, particularly in that 07 postseason run. So I would imagine he will get more cheers than he will get boos, because I'm not sure. I guess the only thing Rockies fans would be upset about are some of the comments he made, you know, earlier in spring training in that USA Today article with Bob Nightingale. I know a couple of his friends, particularly Nolan and Tyler, were Tyler Chatwood, Nolan Arenado, were not happy with his comments about the Rockies training facility as a country club.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, outside of that, Rockies fans really don't have anything to be angry about.
Now, since you said, obviously, that Chulo doesn't really want to address this, is there? Have you gotten any sense that maybe the other players are sort of really want to win these games for him just because of everything that has gone on?
I would think so, right? Like, I would, well, obviously, look, they've lost four of the last seven. So whether it's the Rockies or not,
right,
they definitely need some wins. And not to look past the Rockies, but they've got Cleveland to come home to over the Canada Day weekend, and they've just been raking. I think they've won like nine straight. And so, yes, they want to win, but you have to think, because they are such a tight-knit group, they've gotten so close together and so quickly, really, when you think about it. Some of Troy's closest friends in the Blue Jays clubhouse are, you know, Josh Donaldson and Ryan Goins, and, you know, gosh, I could go on and on. Jose's in there. I mean, there are a lot of people that have gotten close to Troy quickly in such a short period of time. So I have to think that they are really going to maybe put in that extra effort and really try to come up with wins for him. And you have to, geez, I can't even imagine what he's thinking as he's waking up today. Just the amount of pressure that he's probably putting on himself. Now, granted, he's played awfully well since he came back off the DL. I think over the last six games, I saw the last numbers, he was 381 average, three home runs with a 370 OBP. And but think about it. He's going into Coors Field, and he'll look up at the scoreboard, and he'll see a 219 average with 11 home runs. That's certainly not the Troy Tulowitzki from the Rockies days. So on one hand, you know, he's coming in there thinking, I've got to just show these people, you know, what they missed out on. But on the other hand, then you got to think that's just so much pressure on this guy, so much emotion on the day, and he's going to have friends and family out there, and really the entire baseball world is going to be looking at this game tonight and at his homecoming. So I'm really hoping for a good result for the Blue Jays as a whole, but I'm really pulling for him to have a really good series.
And I think there's going to be a serious, tension or atmosphere there. And I think that's what makes baseball games in a lot of cases more interesting. You know, in a schedule of 162 games, you do have a few standouts for reasons other than someone's in a playoff run.
Absolutely. I agree.
What I wanted to sort of transition to was, you have now, you were in Toronto last year for the playoff run. You were a Boston media cohort member during their big playoff runs. Did you notice a big difference between those two cities about how they approached or how they reacted when their team, you know, got back into it? Because they had both had long droughts, right?
They did. I will have to say that having been a Boston transplant for 4.5 years and having watched the 92-93 World Series teams in my hometown of Toronto, and not growing up in New England, I kind of didn't get the whole angst from Red Sox Nation, this, you know, this pining of 86 years. I really didn't understand it, because I was thinking, what's the big deal? The Blue Jays just won back-to-back World Series. So when I was in Boston, as much as, you know, I had read about all, you know, the trials and tribulations of the Red Sox, when it actually happened in 04 and people were going to cemeteries with Red Sox paraphernalia and glasses of champagne because their fathers and grandfathers and, you know, late relatives couldn't be there, it really opened my eyes to thinking, wow, this was more than just a championship to these people. It was the heart and soul that they'd followed this franchise through generations and generations of failure, where, you know, watching, again, the 92-93 series, for people in Toronto, it was such a new thing for us, and it was such a joyous and you know, such a big celebration. I really can't compare the two, the 04 and the 2015 one. Well, first of all, they fell short of the World Series, but having, you know, have that feeling of being in a playoff run was so exciting and so, you know, rejuvenating for baseball fans in Canada. But it really, I can't say it was the same in Boston when you think about 86 years of real failure for a franchise that, you know, so many people had hung their hopes and their dreams on. And when 04 came around, it was just this overwhelming, I don't know if it was relief, almost like a, you know, I like to think of it as a can of pop. Someone shook and then all of a sudden popped open in this just gush of of pure emotion and elation. So because the Jays have not yet won the World Series since the time that I've covered them, I really can't compare the two, but they're two still very exciting moments in my career. But I would have to pick, if you were asking me right now, that 04 Boston Red Sox World Series championship is just something that I don't think I'll ever experience again, just because of the history of that franchise.
Oh, ooh, so angry words there.
And that concludes our interview.
But seriously, though, you were hosting Sports Desk with Nesson, right? And then you were at MLB Network. And is this your first time being basically a full-time on-the-field personality, aside from your occasional outside studio interviews?
I guess. I think I'm losing you guys just a bit. So if you can't hear me, just let me know. It is my first time following one particular team on a full-time basis. That's correct. When I was in Boston, I actually filled in on the sidelines for their usual reporter. It was Eric Fried at that time, terrific, terrific, talented reporter. I was in the studio, so whenever Eric was on vacation or he was, you know, not working that day or called in sick, they would always ask me to fill in on the sidelines for the Red Sox. And then when I worked at Major League Baseball Network, I was lucky enough to get flown into whatever city MLB Network's game of the week was. And, you know, was lucky enough to work with Cott and Costas. So, I would have to say this is the first real opportunity that I've had to follow one team on a more regular basis. And it's been, I got to be honest with you, it's been a lot of fun, particularly with this group, with their personalities, with their talent. It's certainly a lot of fun to cover.
And I was wondering, like, in that role, right, with the, where you're down on the field with the players, do you sort of feel more engaged with the team in that position than you would in your normal roles?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people ask me, particularly when I was in Boston, you know, whenever they come into town, I get teased a lot, oh, who are you cheering for, the Red Sox or the Blue Jays? And I always tell them, you know, that 04 team, there was an emotional connection to a lot of the players because, you followed them so intently for a long period of time. I would say you develop relationships with some of these guys. You try to win, you know, their trust. You get to, you know, really delve into their work ethic, you know, some of their thoughts into going into game action, where in studio you would always just get a lot of sound bites and you really can't gauge and really can't formulate any type of opinion about them from just sound bites. But yeah, being on the field and being able to talk to them on a regular basis, and I always think it's very important to not only, you know, approach them and speak to the players when you need an interview, but just on a daily basis, asking them how they're doing, asking them how their families are doing, asking them how their kids are doing and what they've been doing, you know, as hobbies, and just try to really understand them as human beings and not just professional athletes.
So I am curious, because as a sideline reporter, you often get put into the same sorts of situations over and over again where whoever just got the walk-off hit or the big strikeout or whatever is brought over to you. How do you look at avoiding the cliche or avoiding the sort of rubber stamp interview that you often get on the sidelines? Because I'm sure you think about that.
Yeah, that's a
question. A lot of the questions involving baseball, you really can't get away with not asking, obviously, their approach, how the ball is feeling coming out of the pitcher's hand. But a lot of times, it's just that extra bit of homework, extra bit of research. I mean, for me, as I'm sitting there in the camera well, not only am I scoring the game at the same time, I know about all the apps that are out there, but I'm so old school. Plus, I love to score the game because it just keeps me engaged. I've got to pay extra attention. So the apps that are out there right now are great because in between innings, I'll just kind of double check my scorecard to the app. But I really feel like keeping a scorecard keeps me engaged in the ball game. And so as I'm doing that, I'm also, for example, if we're in the fifth or sixth inning and the Blue Jays are winning and Kevin Pillar is your star at that point, I'm then quickly going into my little iPad and trying to figure out, maybe some of the things that Kevin Pillar had talked about the last time he had a good game. Maybe look at some of the previews, look at some of the numbers going into the game. And I'm doing this as the game is going. So, yeah, it takes a little bit of extra effort. But at the end of the day, I think that allows you to kind of formulate a different type of question or maybe go at the question in a different angle. So you're not, as you said, you're not kind of going to those cliched questions all the time. For me, just going back to your basic, ask the W's, where, the who, stay away from the yes and no answers that you're going to get. So that just comes to a lot of experience, a lot of practice. I'm sure over the course of my career have asked some questions that I probably could have formulated a different way to get a better answer. But that just comes with, the time and learning and just knowledge in baseball in general. Because having never played Major League Baseball or never sniffed the field as a professional athlete, I've got to take that extra step. I've got to work just a little bit harder to come up with, intelligent questions that are meaningful and interesting to the viewers.
And in addition to that, do you often find that you're fighting with players who don't really want to be talking after a game and you sort of have to coax things out of them?
Yeah, it's interesting you asked that question. And for, Edwin, for one, I've been trying to chip away at him. For someone that, English is not their first language, it's very, difficult for him to want to appear on camera without an interpreter. But the funny thing is, he actually speaks English very well, but he doesn't believe he does. So until I can convince him that, Edwin, it's okay to come on, after you've collected four RBIs, to come on at the end of the game and talk to me without an interpreter, or even with an interpreter. I think for Edwin, and I was talking to Josue Pelle, who is the interpreter, I said, I don't understand, why doesn't he want to come on camera? I speak to him off camera in perfect English. I understand everything he says. And he said, a lot of the times they understand English, 100%, but they don't want to be misquoted or taken out of context because they can't find the specific words to, describe what it is that they wanted to say. So I guess there have been some guys that have been burned in the past because their English or their attempt at answering a question in English got misconstrued or taken out of context. And they're afraid it either makes them look silly, foolish, or is not the message that they wanted to convey. So I'm going to keep chipping away at it every day. I say to Edwin, one of these days, and he looks at me and he says, one day, with a smile. But I just, I just want to, chip away at him. I try to, gain his trust. And it's either that, guys, or I end up, taking Spanish this off season. So one of the two things is going to happen. Either that's going to happen or he'll finally, come on camera. Because his English is very good, and it's a matter of me trying to convince him that, fans out there, baseball fans, particularly Blue Jays fans, would love to hear from him. Like, they just want to hear from him. And, the convincing continues. We'll see what happens. Maybe I'll nab him by the end of the season.
Based on his facial expression when told that he was coming off an 0-for-19 before that home run, I don't think he needs to say anything. I think he could just go on and do.
Honestly, And he is, and, you know, I was talking to Michael Saunders about this. He is one of the funniest guys in the clubhouse. And it's so, you know, it's such a shame that, you know, Jays fans out there, and you got a glimpse of it then, like his facial expressions. He, you know, he has just funny things to say, and he just isn't comfortable right now, anyways, to go on camera. But he's one of the most delightful people that you could ever, you know, want to engage in a conversation with. And like I said, it's just, you know, trying to get him to understand that, you know, English is not his first language, so, you know, we're going to give him a big leash. So there's nothing to be afraid of as far as getting in front of the camera and talking. So we'll see. So, yeah, getting back to your, you know, original questions, there are guys that, you know, are shy. There are guys that, like in Edwin's case, don't feel comfortable speaking English on camera. And again, you've got to find a way to just kind of earn their trust off camera, and then, you know, work your relationship with these guys. And hopefully, you know, the next time you have a conversation with them, they'll give you a little bit more candid answers. I've found that, especially with Marco Estrada, who's making the start in game one. Marco was very shy. And I think, you know, we've worked at a good relationship in that if you saw my last conversation with him, he was smiling. He was a little bit more candid in, you know, talking about some of the things he'd gone through health-wise. And you won't necessarily get that all the time if you just, you know, spend your time saying hello to these guys and asking something from them. And that, to me, if there's any, you know, aspiring broadcasters out there, that to me has been my biggest lesson is you see these guys every day. Don't just talk to them when you need something from them. You know, ask them how their families are doing, their, you know, their latest family vacation, what they did on the All-Star break. And that's how you really start to develop trust and relationships with these guys.
Well, that's cool. That's actually really good advice. Not that we're actually broadcasters, but there are people that listen who I'm sure are aspiring to do that.
Oh, I enjoy you guys. So I consider you guys broadcasters from a different medium. That's
Thank
all
you.
It is.
We appreciate that.
I bought a microphone and everything.
I'm telling you, the microphone puts you over the top. You're certainly a bona fide broadcaster with the microphone.
So in your case, obviously you are a broadcaster and you've done various different aspects of it. Is this where you want to be now, or are you looking for something that you're trying to get into down the road?
Oh, good question. I mean, believe it or not, I was a late bloomer. I was 30 when I started, and I'm in my 40s now, so I've been at it for 15 years. And I've, you know, have had the experience of working in the United States for almost 10 years. I've had the experience of, you know, working here at home. You know, I've been lucky I haven't, you know, had to work too far from Toronto, having worked in Boston and New York. But I don't know. I am interested in getting into, you know, different parts of broadcasting. I don't know if I'd want to ever, you know, be a television executive or anything like that. I don't think I'm smart enough to be, be an executive. But I always think, I don't know. I don't know. I've loved everything that I've done. I've done studio work. I've done, you know, reporting. I've done sidelines. I've been on a U.S. national platform. I've been really, really lucky. I've surrounded myself with very smart people, good people in the industry. I don't know. I mean, I'm always interested in something new. So if someone, I don't know, presents something, I'm definitely open to it. I'd love to do these podcast things because I'm so not into, like, the new virtual stuff. I'm so not good on social media, but something like that is always kind of neat to delve into. Cause I know digital media is something that is just huge now. I'm so old school, but I'm open to anything. If my career, you know, ended, you know, not in the near future, I would be very grateful because I was able to be put in situations where a lot of people are still struggling to get there. And I've been lucky enough to had all those experiences. And I guess at the end of the day, you work hard and you have a good work ethic and you can do almost anything you want.
That is a very, very positive note. Now, before we wrap it up completely, We do appreciate you coming on and joining us. We're going to help maybe you improve your social media presence, because you mentioned it wasn't very good.
Oh,
so we're going to let our listeners judge if your social media presence is up to snuff. What is the Twitter handle where we can follow you?
Okay, it's at the Hazel May, and I found out it's only because I guess there's other Hazel May out there. I have no idea. It was someone actually came up with my Twitter handle because, again, not smart when it comes to social media, and they said, "Well, you can be at HMay_da da da da," and I said, "Well, can it just be at Hazel May?" And they said, "Well, no, because that's taken." I'm like, "How's that taken? I'm right here." And so it's at the Hazel May, and I am, you know, I don't think I try to be funny or anything like that. I feel like my role is to just pass along information to people. You know, the odd time I will give an opinion, but at the end of the day, I'm a sports fan like everybody else. I'm not, you know, I'm not an analyst. I report things that I've been told that I'd like to pass along. People tell me that I'm supposed to engage more. So I'm still trying to figure out how you engage people. Just have like regular conversations with total strangers on social media. I don't know. You guys can help me out on that front. I have no idea how to do that.
All right.
Okay. You guys totally have to help me. And then I don't have a Facebook account, which someone said is totally bad. I have an Instagram account because I have a dress like business on the side. But outside of that, oh my gosh, like someone said, "Are you on Snapchat?" And I thought, "What?"
You don't want to be on
like,
Snapchat.
I was like, "What are you talking about?" Yeah, I have no idea what that is. So you guys need to kind of guide me into this social media world because apparently I'm missing out.
Oh, totally. All
right.
Totally. All right.
Challenge.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been speaking with the Hazel May, not to be confused with some other Hazel May, who, of course, you can see on Sportsnet pretty much any Blue Jays game of the week. We really appreciate you dropping by, Hazel. We had a good time.
Hey, thanks. Me too. And guys, call me up anytime when you want to talk baseball and social media and all that stuff.
All right. Sounds good. Take care.
All right, take care, you too.
And that was the lovely Hazel May. I am so glad we got a chance to talk to her.
Yeah, it's actually cool to get, you know, the perspective from Colorado about how it's going on and Tulo's mindset, which, I mean, we saw the first game, we got a really nice hand from the crowd, which was nice.
Yeah. I forgot to mention beforehand, we of course recorded that just prior to game one in Colorado. So, all that will make more sense now that you realize that.
And if people were wondering why we didn't talk about his return, it's because Hazel covered it very well.
Alrighty. So we're going to go to the questions list. Does that make sense? Yes, of course it does. So we're going to start with Wheezy T. Well, okay.
Sure.
Wheezy T. That's four E's. Why do the trade JB folks never bring up the fact that a team in contention wouldn't want to part with what JB or EE would garner? We'll let you take that one, Josh.
Well, I mean, it's kind of, this actually ties into the second question, so we should maybe read them both.
Okay.
Greg?
Oh, that's how it's going to be, is it?
Yeah, well, you're asking me to answer, so you read the second one.
What kind of player package would we get? Names as examples would be nice if we did end up trading Bautista or Encarnacion. So the first question seems to presume major league assets.
These really do tie together because, well, Wheezy T's general point was that you can't trade Bautista to a contender because they'll never give you something that's going to help now, right?
Right.
And Brian's question was, who would you get? Well, the answer is basically it would have to be a three-team deal. It's the only way it would make sense. You would trade Bautista or Encarnacion if you could. You know, like, there's no real reason to do this, which I'm sure we all agree about. You know, and they have their 10-5, right? So they can veto any deal. But if you could, you trade them to a contender who then trades the prospects to a third team who then sends you a pitcher. That's the only way it would make sense.
And again, you get a pitcher for the starting? No, you get a reliever, essentially, don't you? I mean, does this starting rotation actually need help?
Well, it depends on what you're doing with Aaron Sanchez, right? If Aaron Sanchez is going to the pen and you get a starter, then you solve both problems.
So my question for you, Nick, is are you dizzy yet?
No. I am following, and I definitely see the need to do that, too, because if you look at kind of like the hitters that got traded at the deadline last year that you think would be most comparable to Batista, somebody like Cespedes, Michael Fulmer was the big piece coming back, and he was still a little ways away from the majors when he got traded. So, you know, as complicated as it is, it probably is going to have to be the way you're saying it is, where there's got to be a three-team deal.
Yeah, which is essentially why it's just not going to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, maybe the assumption by some folks is that the Blue Jays will have magically fallen out of contention.
Well, but I mean, if that happens, then this changes entirely, right? Then you definitely trade one or both of them if you can. And they wouldn't veto a trade at that point, because why would they want to stick around on a losing team? But do either of you think that the team is going to fall out of contention to the point where they'd want to trade those guys?
No.
No, I don't think so.
I think the AL East is just enough of a disaster that even the Yankees aren't going to be sellers at the deadline.
Yeah, Randy Levine will definitely agree with you. He blew up on some reporters today when they asked him that.
Like a week ago, didn't he talk about selling?
Yeah, and then so this sounds like this could be a do-over too, but he's like, I don't pay attention to any of that. That's for you guys with nothing more important to write about than to write nonsense. And then he says, like, the difference is that most of you guys have never run anything, and we have a lot of history here of knowing what we're doing. They weren't criticizing. They were just asking.
Maybe he'll hire Brian Price when they fire Girardi.
Ooh, that would be good with Brian Price in the New York media.
That'd be, oh man, now this has to happen.
It'd be the best 45 seconds on record before he got sent packing again. All right, who wants to ask the next question? Because I don't like asking all the questions.
All right, well, we'll ask Brian's other question, which was, well, related to, I guess he's in the negative vote here, because whose contract would Atkins jump on dumping first, Tulo or Martin? It's an interesting thought process. Like, if the team were to go in the tank
and he had to get rid of somebody salary wise, who does he dump?
Yeah,
Nick? I would. Yeah, Nick.
Well, I'm guessing he would go with who's ever is easiest to dump.
And in a perfect world, though, like if he could just get rid of one of them,
right? I'm going to say Tulo. His contract's longer, and he might be a little more intimidated by the extra years than Martin's. Although it's only 2 years longer.
Correct.
Although that's $40 million, or $44 million. So I'm going to say Tulo just because he's got the extra years.
I'm going to say Tulo as well, because you really can't replace Russell Martin with a full-time catcher, even a not very good full-time catcher, with any ease. They don't come along very often. Whereas you can probably fudge your way into a no-hit good field shortstop somewhere, and I do mean better than Ryan Goins or Darwin Barney, and replace that guy. But who do you get to catch in this organization right now? Or as a free agent?
Yeah.
Nobody's dreaming on Sanchez? That's just me?
I think it's just you.
Yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh man. I think AJ Jimenez, it would
he's
be
not the guy. He got put off the 40 man.
Wow. The catcher of the future is like the curse in all of baseball, isn't it? I will throw this one to you, Nick. What should we make? This is from Mike, Go Sens Go 101. What should we make of Joe Biagini's June?
Oh, I think not to bang this drum again, but you know, this is the bullpen we signed up with, and I think we're just going to have to kind of strap ourselves in and feel the G's of the ups and downs that come with having some, you know, less than elite, not really established pitchers back there, you know, other than Osuna, and just hope like hell that Cecil gets back here soon and Morales is effective. Yeah.
So what do you make of it? Go ahead.
Well, just in terms of more specifically what's happening with Biagini, I mean, you sort of alluded to this in general, that like with these guys, it's just they're up and down. But in his case, not only is the league seeing him more than once now and getting the sense of that he's not really a bat-missing guy, his stuff is just down, taking a step down. His curveball is moving two and a half inches less than it was in April.
Which is definitely enough to make a big difference to somebody trying to hit one.
Right, so it might just be overuse. He needs a little bit of a setback. I don't know. I mean, he's a rookie, and this kind of thing does tend to happen.
So for those of you who haven't been paying attention, his batting average against, well, yeah, we'll just go batting average against. In April, was .269. It was really excellent, .192 in May. In June, it's been .387. So essentially, yes, everyone has turned into Mike Trout against Joe Biagini, and it's probably not actually that bad. Nothing is ever that bad, is it?
Not with relievers, I don't think. You know, they're never as bad as they look, and they're never as good as they look for the most part, too.
Yep.
Fair enough. That takes us to the... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I feel like I've only spoken in platitudes about relievers.
Well, I don't know. It kind of sums it up.
Sometimes that's all we have. All right, we have one do-over ready to go from you, yeah. Mr. Josh.
So Curt Schilling is back in the news again because he came up basically talking about ESPN, his former employer, and whether he would work for them again. And, well, after saying a bunch of dumb stuff about their political leanings and all that, which, you know, that's what he does, that he drops this. The only danger is if you have to work for someone you don't respect and that doesn't respect the First Amendment. This represents our company bullcrap is laughable. Why on earth would anyone care what they don't know? Think. I don't know, that last sentence he said weird and it didn't make any sense. But the First Amendment is not you can say whatever you want without repercussions.
No. It's very specific. It's the government can't stop you from saying something.
Yes. And these people like Schilling always like, oh, it's free speech. We have the right to free speech. Yes, but you don't have the right to free speech without consequences.
I think the other thing is the network is free to express what it does or does not want to express as a broadcaster. So if there's something they specifically don't want to say and Schilling is saying it, well, he's impinging upon their freedom of speech by saying something they don't want said.
Mm-hmm. And every company everywhere is going to be like that.
Of course. The hashtag brand.
There's a long history of conflating what you're legally allowed to say and what you can basically say in your workspace without dealing with ramifications. And like, I think it's kind of like heavy-handed of him or to think that that's not the case or that somehow this theoretical company that he's talking about exists outside of that space where they've put forward values and ideas and things like that. Like, yeah, he needs more than a do-over, I think.
Well, yeah, I'm curious.
He needs a hard reset.
Maybe he had one of those companies that just ended up bankrupting the state of Rhode Island.
So my question, Josh, really is, how are you going to frame this as a do-over? What does he need to...
Duel. Just don't speak. Just when you see a microphone, run the other direction.
Typical do-overness. Nick,
really, just read the amendment. Learn what it means before you talk about it.
If he comes on to the show here and reads First Amendment, then we'll give him the do-over. No problem. We won't ever speak of it again. Can you imagine that Curt Schilling on our little show, little program, reading?
Just reading the First Amendment.
That'd be awesome. Moving right along.
Use your clout. Make it happen.
Nick's clout. I didn't know.
We don't have any clout.
You had another thought, a gold star.
Nick did.
I want to give a gold star to that bird. It wasn't in St. Louis, but it was against that bird that flew just out of the path of the Adam Wainwright pitch, because I don't know if it was luck or skill on that bird's part, but it was really impressive, especially seeing like what can happen when that goes wrong with the famous Randy Johnson pitch. I saw that bird fly fly right by the Waino pitch. And, you know, after dealing with the existential grief and implications of just thinking of how random that was, I was like, wow, that bird is fantastic. Like, good on that bird.
And not only did it dodge the pitch, Chelsea Cuthbert was swinging at the pitch too, and he missed the bat too.
He was, yeah. I mean, there's got to be a spot in the low minors for that bird somewhere. You can do something with that rod.
So I always wonder when things like that happen: is it a daredevil bird or a depressed bird?
Ooh. Well, he dodged, so he's a daredevil.
maybe he's a depressed bird who had second thoughts. Just at the last split second, like
thrill junkie. Yeah.
Maybe Yadi Molina talked him off the edge.
I've heard he is persuasive.
He's a team leader. Like, he's always been a team leader. So
MVP.
And right. A bird whisperer. Okay, yeah. That is a ridiculous note to end the official part of the podcast on. I would like to announce that our survey, if you are reading this or listening to this on the day of release, our survey for our little podcast is still open for that final day. You can submit entries to win a free jersey of your choice from the Blue Jays shop. So please go ahead and do that. We've got lots of great opinions and feedback from a bunch of people already. Add your name to the list. Do either of you gentlemen have a final thought?
Nick, would you like to go first?
Yeah, sure. So my final thought is going to be on the next 3 months of Troy Tulowitzki, because as a fan of baseball and as a guy who followed baseball for years, Troy Tulowitzki was one of the very best players in all of baseball. And then he got traded to Toronto, and he has become one of the very worst players in all of baseball, but not a very good player. And I am very curious to see, now that he's heating up, what kind of player he's going to be. Because there's a chance he can become the player he was in Colorado. I don't think he's the player we've seen so far in Toronto. And so I'm very, very interested to see what the new baseline is. You know, is he a guy with some power that, you know, that doesn't hit for the average that he did before? Or is he... you know, is he his former self, or is he something else? And I think, you know, the next few months are really going to be the first time we kind of get to see that. And as always, hopefully he just doesn't get injured and we can figure it out what it is.
That'd be nice.
He has been a bit of a mystery. And I think when the team goes to decide what to do with the massive wave of departing free agents, that how Tulo's performing probably has a lot to do with how they structure a rebuild, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Josh.
Can you guess what my final note's going to be about?
I'm sorry, there isn't time.
Gotta happen. Gotta stay true to my brand. Marco Estrada.
Yeah, apparently did he have a start last night?
He did, and his streak continues. He is now, his major league record streak of 6-plus inning starts with 5 or fewer hits is up to 12, 2 higher than the next best ever. During that time, batters are hitting 142, 229, 298 against him.
I'm sure
that's a pretty good stretch.
Our listeners are thrilled to hear that again, Josh. Thrilled.
Hey, I'm going to keep saying it. Just at least I'm not mentioning in the main part. Also, Bo Schultz is back, which is awesome.
Show Bolts!
No?
No?
No, yes. Show Bolts.
Indeed.
Friend of the podcast.
True. It's still a cool sounding nickname. All right. Do I have a final thought? I have trouble with final thoughts on times when the team is 1-3 since we last talked. I have trouble maintaining my positivity. So I'm going to leave it for this week, which means that I am going to say that, I have been Greg Wisniewski at Coolhead 2010, and you have been Joshua Housam at Joshua Housam, and Nick Dyka at... Where are you at, Nick?
Just Nick Dyka. There's not a lot of it.
No hashtags? No dashes?
You can't put a hashtag in a Twitter name.
No slashes? No, you can't do that either, can you?
It's nope. Just Nick Dyka.
Dyka, yeah, no D-I-K-A, correct?
That's correct, yeah. No underscores, no nothing.
Just, and our guest has been Hazel May of Sportsnet. And we'd like to thank you all for listening along, and we'll see you next week. Mm-hmm.